And there are other reprints. There's a technical report section on that website, and there's a lot of reprints in there, PDFs, of a lot of papers from the biometric research branch relating to the analysis of gene expression data. Also, that's where the BWHL software is. And there's also, I don't know if you've noticed, there's a relatively new, we created a BWHL's data archive. For two purposes. One, to make available a lot of data, published data from fairly prominent publications. For the most part, cancer data from clinical studies, and we've sort of imported that data into BWHL's projects with the clinical data associated with that, that the authors of the paper made available. And so we have some 20-odd, I think, projects on that website. So it gives you sort of a wealth of data to have access to reanalyze, or just play with. And it also gives you a place for posting your data if you want. A lot of publications, a lot of journals require you to make your data publicly available. And so we thought that might be a way to do it in a for BWHL's users in a way that's actually both convenient for them and actually more useful for the potential using audience. Because actually when you access something from this archive, it's very easy to use. You go to the archive and there's a little README file for each of those projects that tells you what the study was about. And then all you do is you click on it, you download it, you unzip it, and then you just open the project workbook, and it's all there. There's no importing of the data. You just sort of look at your experiment descriptor worksheet that we've created, and you can see what kind of clinical information is there associated with the data, and you can sort of jump right in. And we have plans for one of the future releases of BRBRA tools to try to develop some tools that permit inter-project analyses. Like if somebody develops a signature for prognosis in breast cancer in one study, we're going to try to develop some tools so that you can use that signature easily on your data with your platform that sort of does all of the necessary housekeeping steps for doing that, enabling you to see whether that signature is predictive, say, of outcome for your patients. This was planned to be really an analysis workshop rather than a course, and so we really advertised it for BWHL tools users. And we sort of, although we could have done it with them, the Center for Information Technology, we're using their classroom here, making their laptop available, their laptops available. And in some ways that would have been easier, but on the other hand, we felt like since it's a workshop, you should be, how are you going to have a workshop? It'd be better if you bring your own laptop with your data installed, your data already imported into BRBRA tools. We really wanted to focus more on analysis issues rather than on the nitty-gritty details of how do I get my data into BRBRA tools. We do have this, currently with BRBRA tools, the current version available is 3.4. Just released a stable version of 3.4. We've had the 3.4 beta available for some time. We have sort of an early version of 3.5 essentially available on a CD that has some enhancements on it. It has a new data import wizard to sort of make it easier to get your data into BRBRA tools, and it has a new data analysis wizard that we're sort of curious for getting some feedback about. It's the idea, as I mentioned before, is to sort of lead you through the steps of thinking about your objectives and your platform to find the right set of analysis tools, and then to give you some quick information about the pros and cons and the differences among those analysis tools, and then to permit you to launch one of those analysis tools. Thinking that some of the still, you know, really the analysis of microarray data is really complicated, and most, you know, a lot of the people who are doing it are not statisticians, and they actually have a lot of other things that they're trying to do too in the laboratory or in the clinic, and so I think the ideal is to really have a statistical collaborator, but there's lots of people who don't have that available. And so we're trying to make it easy, but also in a way that doesn't leads to quality analysis. So not just easy to analyze your data, but easy to educate yourself about what makes for good analysis of your data. It's like I think Einstein said about theories, they should be as simple as possible, but no simpler. So we want the analysis to be as simple as possible, as simple as appropriate, but no simpler. And so if you are, we also have a sort of an enhanced survival risk group prediction tool on this CD. And so if you're interested in, if you're involved with survival risk group prediction, it probably would be good after I finish my talk to sort of have either Amy or Supriya update your version of BRBRA tools with this. And if you're interested in trying out either the import wizard or the data analysis wizard, or willing to try out the data analysis wizard to give us some feedback on it, we'd like people to try it out right here today so we can see how it's working. Of course, perhaps the most important step of a data analysis. Oh, anyway, before I get into the details of my presentation, so the plan is I'm going to talk probably for about 2 hours on data analysis stuff, and then basically the rest of the day will be free. All of the people, myself and people from our group, will be available, and there's a cafeteria right in the adjacent building. There's restrooms just down the hall to the left. And basically, we'll be here, and you can sort of do things at your leisure. You can leave at any time you'd like to leave, including right now if you decide this really is what you had hoped for. Any questions before we get started? Okay. So, you know, a key step in any analysis or in any project is trying to be clear about your objectives. And I think it almost doesn't deserve stating, but, you know, there was a lot of hype about microarrays, that it's like a microscope and you don't really have to have objectives. You just sort of look at your cells and you get answers to questions that you never even thought of asking. And it would be nice if things were that easy, but I think for the most part, good projects come from having a little bit more specific objectives than that, not sort of gene-specific, because if you're interested in a particular gene or a particular pathway, then there's probably other assays that may be better than expression microarrays. But really, in some other aspects of objectives, you probably do need to be more specific, both in terms of for what samples you're going to need to be using, for how many of them, if you're using a two-color array, for what kind of a hybridization plan to use in terms of what should be co-hybridized with what on the same array, and for analysis strategy. Now, microarrays are useful for a wide variety of kinds of studies and kinds of objectives, and but many of them fall into one of these three kinds of categories. They don't all fall into these three categories, but many of them do. And the categories are class comparison, or class prediction, or class discovery. Class comparison is basically gene finding. You have expression profiles. You have some other variable, some of your arrays came from tumors, some came from normal tissue, or some came before treatment, and some came after treatment, or some came from high-grade tumors and some came from low-grade tumors, or you have a grading, or some of them came pre-treatment and some of them came at various times after treatment. And somehow you want to relate, you want to find the genes that are in some one way or another correlated with this other variable. And it's not class comparison if this other variable is categorical, like normal versus tumor. In general, it's just that there's some other variable, and you're looking for what genes are sort of in some one way or another correlated with this other variable. And so that's the kind of thing I'm calling class comparison. And then there's a class prediction in which the focus is not really on just finding the genes, but coming up with a predictor. In other words, you may have patients, some of whom responded to a given treatment, some of whom didn't. See, is there room at any of the desks? And so some of the patients, say, responded to the treatment, some of them didn't. You have pre-treatment expression profiles on their tumors, and you want to come up with predictive classifier based on gene expressions of key genes that permits you to predict in the future, given an expression profile, whether that patient is likely to respond to that treatment. That's one example sort of a class prediction problem. And a lot of the times, really, class prediction comes from sort of medical applications. The focus is on the prediction. Part of the steps of getting a good predictor is finding the genes that are useful for making the prediction, but that's not the ultimate goal of a class prediction. The ultimate goal of the class prediction is developing a predictor that is in evaluating that predictor. A set of genes is not a predictor. And so, whereas class comparison, a lot of times the focus is on mechanism. Class prediction, the focus is on prediction. And then there are the studies of class discovery where there is no other variable. There's just expression profiles. And you just want to know, well, I have expression profiles from all of these tumors. I mean, I was involved with one of these studies very early on with Jeff Trent and Mike Bittner and Paul Meltzer and melanoma. And there really wasn't any other variable that we wanted to relate the melanoma expression profiles to. These were from patients. These were cell lines made from metastases of patients with metastatic melanoma, and short-term cell lines. And really, what we were looking for were these expression profiles homogeneous, or did they sort of sort into very distinct kind of sets? We weren't trying to correlate them with anything because there was nothing particularly interesting to correlate them with. None of the patients really responded very well to therapy. And so really the focus was really just on are there discrete subsets of melanomas. And similarly with genes, the focus could be on, I know some of the genes in a particular pathway and I want to see what other genes have expression profiles that are very similar to those genes. And maybe these new genes that I discover will be also in that pathway. But there's so the big difference is class comparison, class prediction, they have some additional variable in addition to the expression profiles that are sort of key to the objective. And consequently, they are not really clustering problems. And for the most part, clustering is the wrong analysis tool to be using for class comparison or class prediction. For a variety of reasons, often the sort of, you know, the number of genes that are sort of differentially expressed among your classes or informative for prediction, a very small number relative to the overall number of genes. And really, for a pure clustering problem, you don't do gene selection. And so pure clustering may not be very good at distinguishing classes. It doesn't really control for the multiplicity issues involved, and it, from a prediction point of view, it sort of violates the key prescription, the key principle, and that is that there should be a separation between the data used for developing a predictor and the data used for evaluating a predictor. To the extent that clustering can be used for prediction, it sort of violates that. So for class comparison and class prediction, you really want to be using what are called supervised methods. And supervised just means that they're using this other variable that's defining the classes in the process of doing the analysis. And of course, you know, either for class, we're not really in the game of saying, well, I've got this expression profile from, and I've got this expression profile, and I want to compare those two expression profiles. We're not trying to compare two expression profiles. In general, you're trying to say, how does gene expression differ under this condition compared to that condition, or under this tissue compared to that tissue, or for this set of patients compared to that set of patients. And to make robust conclusions of that type, you need to have multiple instances of specimens under this condition and multiple instances of specimens under that condition, so that you can judge the differences relative to the within-class variabilities. And there are, of course, technical replicates, and is distinguished from biological replicates. A technical replicate means if you have an RNA sample, you have some sample of cells, either from growing up a cell line or from disaggregating cells in a tissue, and you extract, say, the RNA or the messenger RNA from that collection of cells, and you can then potentially label it and put it on one array, or label it and put it on multiple arrays. And if you have this one RNA sample, and you put it on, you label it and put it on multiple arrays, those are called technical replicates. They're replicates. They're going to lead to multiple expression profiles, but they're all from the same RNA sample. So that's sort of what a technical replicate is. A biological replicate is sort of anything other than that, where you have your arrays are coming from different RNA samples. For example, you have multiple tumors of, say, that grade, and you and from each one of them, maybe you extract the messenger RNA, you label it, and you hybridize it to an array. So now those are, it may be confusing to call them replicates, but they're biological, we call them biological replicates of the class of that grade of tumor. Or if you're doing a tissue culture experiment, basically if you treat the cells and you grow them up, and then you harvest the cell at a certain time, and you extract the RNA, then you repeat that whole experiment. You treat, you grow up, you harvest, you extract the messenger, and you label it. Those are two biological replicates. So that's sort of the distinction. Now, you know, sometimes expression profiling is done with very small numbers of samples, and sometimes just using technical replicates of a single growth of a single cell line, and for sort of a first look at maybe what's going on, that could be useful. But ultimately, for getting beyond that and, you know, drawing robust biological conclusions and publishable conclusions, generally require independent biological replicates, and you're trying to conclude something about, say, tumor versus normal tissue. You probably shouldn't be talking about one tumor versus the corresponding normal tissue around that one tumor. And technical replicates can be useful for sort of providing an insurance policy that you have at least one good quality array of each specimen. But for the most part, they don't really add a whole lot to the statistical power, say, for class comparison, for comparing, say, different classes, because the a lot of times the biological variability is much greater than the technical reassaying variability, reassaying from the same RNA sample. And so having lots of, a bunch of arrays on the same RNA sample actually doesn't help you very much compared. If you really had your choice, you'd be much better off with multiple RNA samples from of the type that you need. Yeah?
You didn't say in your manual to take those out before doing it.
Well, I was going to mention that. Basically, the idea is you don't want to mix the two together. So if really all you have are technical replicates, if you have one growth of one cell line under this condition and one growth of one cell line under that condition, and you've made multiple arrays on them, you don't want to take those out. It's just that you analyze those. You're not mixing anything because you've got no biological replicates here. You can analyze those without averaging them or anything. It's just that your conclusions then really just apply to that single growth of the experiment. But the stickier problem is if you have both, you did two arrays of every RNA sample, and you also had biological replicates, and so it sort of messes up the variances on a lot of these statistical tests to sort of have those two different kinds of things floating around. And so you have to somehow distinguish one from the other. And you actually could do it in an analysis of variance and have the and not. But it turns out if you do it in a very complicated analysis of variance, it's almost equivalent to averaging them anyway. So the only way it's not really different, equivalent to averaging them, is if you have technical replicates of some and not of others, then it does change your variances somewhat. But so it, to the extent that we're using the simpler analysis tools, we suggest doing one of two things. We always usually have this button, average over, you know, you have some column indicating what are your technical replicates, and it will just average over those technical replicates, because it's got to do something to distinguish the technical replicates from the biological replicates. The alternative, which I did in one case, was this was fairly early on, and we had technical replicates and we had biological replicates, and we had variable number of technical replicates for each sample. And some of the arrays were good, and some were bad, and some were in between. And so what we did was we made an assessment of the quality of each array. And so for each biological replicate, we selected the technical replicate, the best quality. And then the rest of them, we sort of excluded from the analysis. So BRBRA tools was meant to be able to be very general and not be linked to any particular platform or any particular database in which you're keeping your data. And so consequently, both single label arrays, most of which these days, are Affymetrix gene chips, although, you know, there used to be the filter arrays, radioactive filter arrays, and some people were using BRBRA tools to analyze those with radioactive labeling instead in lieu of fluorescent labeling, and there's not a whole lot of that anymore. Nowadays, I mean, some people are analyzing microRNAs, they're using printed arrays, but they're doing it in a single label kind of format. So they're importing their data as single label arrays because they're not using any kind of a reference. You need to have some kind of a common reference of microRNAs, microRNA extracted from some sample. And then, of course, dual label arrays. And a lot of the analysis tools for BRBRA tools were really written assuming that you're using a common reference. Dual label arrays that you've sort of co-hybridized with some common reference, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more. Turns out a common reference is certainly for class prediction or for clustering is very important. If you didn't use that kind of a common reference, if you use some more complicated loop design or something, and if you really want to do class prediction or clustering, it just sort of makes it really complicated. You have to do an analysis of variance, basically, in order to get the estimates that you need then to feed into to those things. For class comparison, some of these other designs can actually be more efficient than common reference designs. And so we do have some tools in BRB Array Tools to permit you to sort of analyze these alternative designs. By the common reference design, I mean where this is sort of your common reference design. Suppose you have two classes. A is tumor and B is normal. And here in this case, we have two tumors. We've got RNA from two tumors, A1 and A2, and two normal tissues, B1 and B2. And we have some kind of a common reference. And so we our experimental specimens, we always label, say, with the same fluorescent dye, in this case red. It doesn't matter which it is here. And whatever this common reference is, we're always labeling it with the other dye. And the objective is, however, to compare the expression profile, say, of the A's to the expression profiles of the B's. The objective here is not really to compare the expression profile of the A's to the expression profile of the reference, or the B's to the reference. And so with a... I'm not going to spend too much time right there because we're really going to focus more on analysis issues. There are issues of what properties the reference should have. A lot of people feel like, well, you'd like to have all of the genes expressed, but not expressed at such a high level that everything is already saturated and you'll never see any upregulation. So, the point is for class comparison or class prediction or clustering, with a common reference design, there's really no need to do any dye swaps, and because you're not comparing the A's to the R's. If you were comparing expression in the A's to the reference, then you'd have to be concerned about, how can I distinguish validly expression in the A's versus in the R's, since I have this confounding by I've always labeled one with one dye and labeled the other one with the other dye, and I know that these dyes have different properties in terms of their affinity for DNA and in terms of their fluorescence, and how do I know that my normalization, and those properties may be gene-dependent, sequence-dependent, and how do I know that I've really sort of normalized all that stuff properly, and that is an issue. So if you're trying to do a direct comparison between the things you labeled in red and the things you labeled in green, then you have to be concerned about potentially using things like dye swap designs. But here we're not actually. If the objective is really to compare the expression profiles in the A's to the expression profiles in the B's, well, the A's and the B's are always labeled with the red dye, and so we're really just using the reference as sort of to give a relative measure of expression. And so we don't really need to be doing dye swapping. So the reference generally serves to control a variation. There's a couple of important sources of variation on printed arrays. One is the variation in the size of the corresponding spots on different arrays, spots corresponding to the same cDNA or oligo. There's usually not, you don't have the control over those spots to the extent that you do, say, on Affymetrix gene chips, have control over the number of oligos that get synthesized at each place on the silicon wafer. And you also have a lot of variation. In a gene chip, you actually circulate the sample around the gene chip, so you have sort of a homogeneous distribution of concentration across the face of the chip, and so it's the same on one as it is for another. And you don't have that when you sort of just put your sample down on a microscope slide and then put down the cover slip. So direct comparisons of the intensity on one at a spot on one slide to the corresponding spot on the other slide, there's a lot of variability associated with it, and it's not really something you want to do. And so it's much. So that's really the purpose of the common reference, is to measure expression in a relative way, so that relative to something at that same spot on that same slide, so that you get rid of those sources of variability. The reference itself is not really the object of comparison. So these discussions about, well, I want to use this reference because it's the same kind of tissue and it's the same this and this. That's usually not what you're using the reference for. You know, usually you're not trying to make a comparison. Well, is the expression higher in my tumors than in the reference? If you are, then that's a different ballgame. But usually that's not what you're trying to use the reference for. And so those discussions are sort of really tangential. So a relative measure of expression will be compared among biologically independent samples from different classes. This was just some data where some people had done something like 50 spots on a single slide of the same cDNA. They had printed the same cDNA at 50 different places on one slide. And then they co-hybridized two cell lines, a messenger RNA from two cell lines, one labeled red, one labeled green, to that single slide. And this is just a plot of the fluorescence intensity in the red channel versus fluorescence intensity in the green channel for those 50 spots. But it's the same cDNA in all 50 spots. And so what you see is a wide variety of the fluorescence intensities in each channel because some of these spots are big and some of these spots are small, even though they tried to print them well. And the distribution of the sample over the face of the slide above the spots are not uniform. This is not even talking about two different slides. This is just on one slide. So, however, the ratio of intensities of the red intensity to the green intensity across the 50 spots is quite constant. So that's sort of the reason for using the relative measure of expression. Yeah.
Is this as much concern with Merkle arrays, or is this more of a concern with sort of homemade arrays?
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know to what extent the commercial arrays are uniform enough printing that would not be a concern. I think it does indicate, though, if you're contemplating using a single label design with some kind of an array, you probably ought to ask to see some data beforehand like this, or, you know, looking at the same spot on different slides to see how much variability there is. This is an alternative to the dye swap design, and I don't really want to emphasize these design issues. We have Kevin Dobbin and I and Joanna Shi have a couple of papers on design issues. But if you're going to, the alternative, and it can be more efficient for class comparison, the alternative is to do away with the common reference and just say, well, I want to compare tumor to normal, and so why don't I just co-hybridize on each slide, you know, label messenger from a tumor versus label messenger from a normal. If I can pair them by patient, that's even better. But even if I don't have a pairing, if my tumors are from tumors and my normal tissues are from other people, I could still randomly pair them, but do away with the common reference and just always co-hybridize a tumor versus a normal. And then on each slide, I'll get some estimate of relative intensity for each each spot, and I can then average those over the different slides. And because I'm sort of balancing off when I measure, when I label the tumors, which dye I label the tumors and which dye I label the normals, I can sort of balance those things and get rid of dye bias that way. Or you can do, the point is, there are alternatives to the common reference design. They can be more efficient for class comparison. There's a variety of alternatives, some of which involve dye swapping, but not dye swapping everything, just doing enough dye swapping so that you can estimate which genes are having a lot of dye bias not removed by normalization. Or you can do some self-self arrays with red and green labeled with the same thing. And we have analysis of variance tools that will permit analysis of any of those experiments. The thing that's limiting, however, is you need to have a very small number of comparisons in mind for your data. In other words, if you want to do a whole lot of different kinds of comparisons and analyses with your data, it doesn't work so well, because usually when you use one of these other designs, you have to say, well, what am I going to co-hybridize with what? And to a large extent, you're saying, well, I want to take one from this class and one from the other class, and I want to compare. And if you want to do all possible comparisons of five different classes, then you're into some very complicated design. So for very simple situations, these kinds of design, direct comparison designs can be efficient. For more complicated experiments, although they lead, in any way, they lead to sort of more complex analysis. Okay, so now let's, start going through some of these analysis tools for class comparison and then for class prediction, and I think we'll see how much time we have. I basically planned here to sort of go through some of these analysis tools, but also to discuss a little bit of theory along as we go along the way. This is just sort of the main dialogue box for the class comparison tool. And you see sort of on the left, there's this issue of, well, what column defines the classes? You know, you probably know with BRB array tools, you have this experiment descriptor worksheet, which is really your personal way of sort of putting in your phenotype information, the variables that sort of describe these different arrays, and they're really your way of driving the analysis. And so each row of that experiment descriptor worksheet corresponds to one of your arrays. And the first column of that experiment descriptor worksheet is just an identifier for that array. And if I think your data was originally had a separate file for each expression data, then I think your identifiers need to correspond to those file names of those expression data files. But beyond that, all of those columns are things that you create to sort of define your data set. And you can actually add columns as you go along. Once you open your project, I think the first tab at the bottom will be for the experiment descriptor worksheet. And you'll probably find, at least for a fairly extensive analysis, that you'll be wanting to create new columns. And BRB Array Tools is sort of oriented to not putting in a lot of fancy programming to permit you to sort of exclude things. And it's sort of oriented to you create a column, and in that column you say, you have some string indicating this class and some string indicating that class and some string of characters indicating a third class, or they can be numbers or whatever you want. And if you want that array excluded from that analysis that's defined by that column, you just leave that corresponding row blank. And so BRB Array Tools is sort of written with the intent that you'll be creating columns as you go along as you need them. And then when you ready, when you're finished with that analysis for that time, you just close your project, and it'll ask you, do you want to save it? And you say, well, yeah, you do want to save it, because then it will save those columns you created will be saved, and so next time you open your project, you'll be able to go from there. So that's what the column defining the classes are. And then there's something about unpaired or paired samples, and I'll talk just a minute about what that is. So paired data means that, well, you're going to compare, say, suppose we're talking about comparing two classes. So pairing means that you have some kind of pairing of the samples in these different classes. So maybe you have pre- and post-treatment tissue from the same individual, or maybe you have tumor and normal tissue from the same patient. And by pairing, what you really want to do is compare these classes, but you're trying to eliminate the individuals as sort of a source of variability. And one example, you know, would be, suppose you have normal tumor. And so if we look at it, and these are paired because they're from the same patient. Well, if we look at it this way, it's starting to look like the tumor expression for this gene is always higher than the normal expression for this gene. However, if we ignored the pairing, it would be less clear because it looks like, well, maybe there's more overlap. And so that's what the idea of pairing is to, if the individual or whatever the basis for pairing is, if there's some variability associated with that you can, and you're not really interested in that, you're interested in the class difference. Yeah.
With the paired data, for time series analysis, when you're just interested in doing a class comparison, I've had a lot of problems. Is there some way that they can run that where you have like four time points, pre, post, and then post, and follow-up for a single individual? And you're interested in the classes between two classes, not the individual time points, but to eliminate the variability, you want to include all the separate measurements you have.
So that basically you would handle that from an analysis of variance. I mean, that's a fairly complicated analysis, and you probably want to have an analysis. It would actually, the appropriate tool for that is probably our mixed effects model analysis of variance plugin that permits you to say that individuals you have multiple repeated measurements on the same individual. That's fairly unusual, but you do have, in your case, repeated measurements on the same individual, and those individuals are just sort of a random selection of people. You're not, and so that's what the random effect is, and then you have time, you know, in terms of those are the times of the measurements of those individuals, and you have different classes. And so what you'd be looking for probably are, I'd have to look back at it, but I think what it gives you is, well, what are the effects of time? What are the differences between classes? And are there genes for which the change of the gene over time is different for your two classes? So, you know, each gene, it'll say, well, it'll give you a gene list saying, what are the genes that are changed? In other words, if there's no interaction, it'll say, well, what are the genes that are changing over time in a way similar for the two classes? And then it'll say, if there's no interaction, what are the genes that whose pattern over time or their lack of pattern over time is the same for the is different for the two classes, and then what are the genes whose change over time differs for the two classes. So I think for something complicated like that, that's probably the best. You could have here, multiple classes. Your classes could be the time. Yeah, here you sort of run out of variables too quickly because you have the classes of time points. You have your other kind of classes, maybe patient normal or whatever, and then and you have a pairing or a blocking variable. But this class comparison. Really is only for sort of, you have some class variable and some blocking variable. In your case, you have two class variables, sort of in a blocking variable, and so you really have to go to that analysis of variance tool. The blocking is sort of a generalization of the idea of class, where suppose you wanted to compare tumor versus normal, and you use two different print sets of arrays, and you have reason to believe that the print sets have different sort of characteristics, and you're really interested in the genes for which there's sort of a consistent tumor versus normal difference across the different print sets, but you want to get rid of the variation in expression level due to the print sets. When you normalize these two color arrays, we're really not going to talk about normalization here. At least that wasn't my plan. But all it really does, the normalization of two color arrays for the most part just balances the red versus green intensities on each array individually. And so it's possible that you could, even after you're doing that, you could have differences between the first print set and the second print set. And so anyway, that would be an example of blocking. You just would create a column in your experiment descriptor file that would say which arrays were from print set 1 and which arrays were from print set 2 and which arrays were from print set 3. And then you would, when you set up your analysis, you would just indicate, yeah, it's paired, but let's block by, and then on that pull-down list, you just select that column you create. And often what would happen is you'd be trying to fill out this dialog box and maybe figure out that that's what you need to do. And so then maybe you'd click on cancel, and then you'd go to your experiment descriptor file, set up that column, and then start this thing again, select class comparison again. We already talked about technical replicates. The other big thing with class comparison or gene finding is the fact that, you're going to wind up with some kind of a gene list, and you're going to say, these are the genes I think are differentially expressed between the classes or are correlated with survival or are correlated with some other variable. And what are you going to be able to say about it statistically? I mean, so is it just, you're really going to publish these? If you're trying to publish it, you have to sort of say something more than, these are the genes that I think are interesting. And you're going to have to give some basis for that. And there's a couple of ways you can do it, but there are all of the different ways are really trying to address the same potential problem, and that is, you know, usually the way we do that, if we want to say, well, we have this condition and that condition, and we're looking at, we have some assay for a single gene, and we're going to look at immunohistochemistry, expression of intensity of antibody staining for a particular antibody against a particular protein, and we have a certain number of samples of this type, a certain number of samples of that type, and usually what we're going to do is we're going to say we got this difference and we did a t-test or we did some other kind of test and it's significant at the p less than 0.05 level. And that's sort of the way we document that we're we have some basis for thinking that there's something going on. The problem with that kind of a documentation, when you maybe have 10,000 genes that you analyzed, is that 0.05 times 10,000 is a big number. So, in other words, what does the 0.05 mean? Well, that's the chance of a false positive finding. So that's the chance of getting significance, even if there's no real difference in expression between those two classes. So that's 5 per 100, 50 per 1,000, 500 per 10,000. So if we analyze 10,000 genes, it means we expect 500 false positives. Now, actually, that expectation is right, even if the genes are correlated, which, of course, many of them are. Their expressions are correlated. But the fact that they're correlated means that the number of false positives has a large variance. So you will, a lot of times you'll see either a lot more than 500 or a lot less than 500. But nevertheless, to have an expectation of 500 false positives is not so good, because it means you don't have much basis for your claim. And even in terms of following it up, knowing how to get some kind of a validation with other kind of an assay or other kind of an experiment, it's just too many false leads to follow up. So the simplest way of dealing with it, not necessarily the best, but the simplest, and often works very well, is just to be more stringent in terms of make that 0.05 something much smaller. And so if you make that 0.05 threshold for significance 0.001 instead of 0.05, making it much more stringent, that's one false positive per 1,000. That's certainly something that's you can generally live with. I mean, there are some difficult class comparison problems where maybe you'll look at all your genes and you'll only find 10 of them that look differentially expressed. For a lot of the other ones, you'll find 100 or several hundred that are differentially expressed. Many times, you find too many because to start understanding biologically. But usually, using an alpha of 0.001, at least for an initial kind of an analysis, gives you adequate control over this multiple testing issue. The other way, and I think that actually even the more accepted way of explaining in how you've dealt with this, how you're controlling for this multiple testing, is sort of not to talk about how many false positives I expected from all of the 10,000 genes I tested, but rather to talk about in the gene list of 90 genes, say, that I'm reporting that I think are differentially expressed, what percentage of those do I think are false positives? So to switch the context from what percentage of all genes that I tested to what percentage of the genes that I, of this gene list that I'm reporting, what percentage of those do I think are false positives? And that's called the false discovery rate. And so, for example, suppose we're testing 1,000 genes, and unbeknownst to us, the true state of nature is that 100 of these are really differentially expressed. This is sort of stated in a contorted way, false null hypothesis. Well, the idea is that the null hypothesis is that the gene is not differentially expressed. And so the null hypothesis is false if the gene is differentially expressed. So of these 1,000 genes, we have 100 that are really differentially expressed between the classes. We don't know that. There's no real way of knowing what's the true state of nature. And in 900 of the cases, the gene is really not differentially expressed. But suppose we analyze our data for these 1,000 genes, and what we find is we find 100 genes that are statistically significant at some level that we pick. Okay?
So we have a gene list that we want to report of 100 genes. In this particular situation, what would our false discovery rate be? Well, if it works out that of these 100 genes, that these are 100 genes, and suppose our test is powerful enough to pick up 90 of the 100 as statistically significant and misses 10 of them, you know, these 900 that are not differentially expressed, suppose we have 10 false positives. And if in that case, if that were the case, then of these 100 that we claim were differentially expressed, we actually have only 10 false positives. And so our false discovery rate is 10 over 100. So it's 10%. So the idea is, I don't know if this example is more confusing than it is clarifying, but the false discovery rate is just of the gene, of the number of the gene list that we're claiming is a significant in whatever sense, what proportion of them, what percent of them are actually false positives. And the thing is, you can't really know ever which ones are the false positives or which ones aren't, but the way you do the statistical method may enable you to calculate something about the expected false discovery rate. For example, suppose we have N genes, like N maybe would be 1,000 or 10,000, and suppose N is 1,000, okay? Suppose N is 1,000, and suppose N is 10,000. And suppose we're going to claim that a gene is differentially expressed if, in fact, when we calculate a p-value for differential expression, we get a p-value of less than 0.001. Okay? So, and suppose when we actually do that on our data, we wind up with 100 genes that are statistically significant. And so K is the number of genes that were actually statistically significant at that level in our data. K genes whose p-value is less than this p star. For the little example I'm making up, p star is 0.001. And so we can estimate this false discovery rate by saying, okay, well, the false discovery rate is supposed to be of the gene, of my gene list that I'm claiming are differentially expressed. So my gene list is 100 genes. So I've got this denominator of K, this denominator of 100. Of that 100, how many do I think are likely to be false positives? Well, I don't know which ones are the real false positives, but I had 10,000 genes, and how many false positives would I expect if I did test at the 0.001 level? Well, it would be 10,000 times 0.001. And so that's why in the numerator, that's the sort of number of false positives I expect. And so the false discovery rate is approximated here by that number of false positives divided by the actual size of the gene list, the actual number of genes in your data. So in this case, N is 10,000, P star is 0.001, so N times P star is 10, and the denominator is 100. So my estimated false discovery rate is 10 over 100, or 10%. So what your claim would be, I've got this gene list, these genes are significant at the 0.001 level, and my expected false discovery rate is 10%. So I think of this gene list, only 10% of them are false positives.
What's an accepted false discovery rate?
I would say the false discovery rate itself has gotten widely accepted as sort of a measure of, you know, how well are you controlling the multiplicity. It's not like the p of 0.05 traditionally has gotten to be the accepted thing. Although some people, I think, use it in that way, I think to me that's pretty stringent. my own, so I don't know what's accepted. My own feeling is a false discovery rate of 10% or less is really good. A false discovery rate of 50% or more is pretty bad. And in between, you know, is in between. In other words, if your false discovery rate is around 20%, I wouldn't be embarrassed publishing that data. But if it's getting much higher than that, then I start getting a little worried.
6 questions is a fraction of one, though, right? In
BLD. Yeah, I think so, yeah. You know, I don't want to go into too much detail. The basic, when you specify, like if we look back on that, on the right-hand side of this dialog box, we have a couple of options for generating this gene list. We're going to just use some significance threshold of univariate tests. And these univariate tests basically are t-tests or f-tests for class comparison. And they do make normal distribution assumptions. And so they have that limitation. These other two options on the right-hand side give you, they generate this gene list using what we call the multivariate permutation test, which is something that several members of our group developed and published. And it is a permutation test, but it's more complicated than a one gene at a time permutation test. It's a SAM-like procedure that actually gives better control of the confidence limit for the level for the false discovery rate than SAM does. But it's in the same spirit as SAM, and there's no real p-value used for sort of controlling the multiplicity issue, but it more directly, based on these multivariate permutations, controls either the proportion of false discoveries or the number of false discoveries, and it controls it at a certain confidence level. So as you can see here, the second option, it's sort of grayed out there, but it would do things. It would control the proportion of false discoveries, and our default is 10% with an 80% confidence.
Could you just explain again one more time the distinction of the advantages of doing univariate versus multivariate?
Okay. So there's three kinds of tests, roughly categories of tests you could use. You could use something like a t-test or an f-test. It was one gene at a time, just univariate. It works okay for, the only problem is it's based on normal distribution assumptions. Now, it's actually working on the level of the log ratio or the log signal. So it's taking logs, so that makes things a little bit more normal than if you just dealt with ratios or something. But it's still approximating p-values based on normal distributions. And the problem is, when you're using stringent levels of significance like 0.001, you're sort of requiring that the normal distribution be a good approximation way out in the tail of the distribution. And normal distributions are often good approximations to many distributions. There's a theorem jokingly called Tukey's theorem that says all distributions are normal in the center. And but the idea is once you get out into the details of these distributions, they start looking very different. And, you know, some of them fall off more rapidly than others. So I often don't worry too much about that. But the second kind of thing you could do is you could do what's traditionally done in statistics. Is you say, well, okay, I'll use a rank test. I'll just use a Wilcoxon test or some other kind of a rank test. And that does, unfortunately, that works okay if you have a lot of arrays. But if you have relatively few arrays per class, that doesn't work at all, because there's just not enough permutations to get extremely small p-values. And so the power of these univariate rank tests, like the Wilcoxon test, is very bad for small sample sizes. And the third thing you can do is you can say, well, I'm going to do it based on permutations, but I'm not going to just do it one gene at a time. And I didn't really want to go through, because these things can be complicated, but what they do is they say, suppose I want to say, well, I want to limit my number of false discoveries to be no greater than 10. So the way they would work is they would say, well, I'm going to permute the class labels as to which is class 1 and which is class 2, and I'm going to do that maybe for all possible permutations or for 1,000 of them if there's too many of them. And for each of these permutations, I'm going to calculate the p-values for differential expression for all the genes. And now, since I'm looking at random permutations, anything I find is, they're all false positives, right? But what I'm going to keep track of is each time I do a random permutation and then I calculate the p-values for all of the genes, I'm going to keep track of the 11th smallest p-value. And in this way, I'm going to generate the null distribution of the 11th smallest p-value. And so now if I want to assure, and I'm going to take maybe the 90th percentile, or the 10th percentile of the 11th small, of this null distribution of the 11th, so that 90% of the time, I'm going to have a number, 90% of the time, let's see, the 11th smallest p-value will be greater than that number. And so now I look at my data and I say, okay, well, which genes am I going to consider differentially expressed for the p-values that I really compute? And those, the p-values I may use may be t-statistic, t-test p-values, but I'm not going to get my gene list by using normal distribution threshold. I'm going to say, well, what's my critical p-value now for interpreting my actual data? Well, what I use for that is what I found was that the 10th percentile of the null distribution of the 11th smallest p-value. And so that assures me that my gene list is very unlikely to contain more than 10 false positives. And so that's the way these multivariate permutation tests work. They're very clever. They become totally non-parametric, even though you use like p-values from t-tests, but because they're based on these permutations, they're completely non-parametric, but they solve the problem of the sort of coarseness of, you know, how can you get an extreme p-value when you're when you don't have many arrays. So they work pretty well even with a small number of arrays, and they take into account the correlation of the genes, which is something that the univariate methods don't. So, and SAM is of the same philosophy, really. So I think they are really good methods. And the one for the false controlling false discovery rate works very similarly. Okay. The one other thing I wanted to go over about the class comparison, remember if we had on this form, this thing down here, should I use the random variance model for these univariate tests? And let's say a little bit about what is that. So just suppose we have two classes and we're analyzing gene J, is it differentially expressed between class 1 and class 2? And, well, if we were going to try to specify that very mathematically, the assumption would be that the expression profile, the level of expression or the log expression for the J gene is normally distributed with some mean for class 1 and some other mean for class 2, and we're going to test that those two means are the same. The only problem is we have these variances, the within-class variance for the J gene. we have to decide what to do with that. And the traditional way the t-test works is it estimates those genes, that variance from the data. Now, usually there's an option, do you want to assume that the variance is the same in class 1 as it is in class 2? With BRBRA tools, we always make that assumption, which in some cases can be a poor assumption, but often you just don't have enough data to estimate them separately. The other issue is you may not have enough data to estimate those variances, even assuming that it's the same in both classes, to estimate them separately for each gene. And so you have this temptation, why don't I assume that those variances are the same for all genes, and then I can get a really good estimate of that variance by sort of pooling the estimates from all of the genes. And the only problem is that's a really bad assumption. And so although some software and like analysis of variance that other analyses of variance where they sort of analyze all genes together and they make that assumption, it's really not a good assumption. And you're sort of left, but you're left with either do it in a traditional way where you estimate your variance separately for each gene, or George Wright in my group and I developed this method which we call the random variance model, which is really sort of a hierarchical model in which you do make an assumption. You don't assume that the variances are the same for all genes, but you assume that there's some distribution, and the true variance for each gene is a sample from that distribution. Now, you don't actually get to observe exactly what that true variance is, but you have data that permits you to. So we published that paper in Bioinformatics, and we basically assume that these variances are independent samples from an inverse gamma distribution, which is a very convenient distribution because what it leads to, you can show then very theoretically that you still, if you estimate the variance according to with this hierarchical model now, you still get test statistics that have T distributions and F distributions, and it carries over to analysis of variance and everything. And so
what's the inverse gamma distribution?
It's just in Bayesian terms, it's sort of the conjugate distribution it's just a form of a distribution. It's always positive. Variances are always positive, and there's no. I think if we understood the structure of the universe, I'm not sure we would understand why the inverse gamma distribution works for that, but. But so I think it's just convenience. In the BRBRA tools, where we use you can also do a test for whether that's a good assumption for your data. So it actually, it's already built in. If you check, I want to use the random variance model, it will do that test. And if it looks like it's not a good assumption for your data, it'll say it's not using the randomized variance model. It's just estimating the variances separately for each gene. Usually it'll be okay. It gives you somewhat more degrees of freedom. For what it does is it means the variance estimates are sort of weighted averages between what it sees for an individual gene and what it estimates for this overall population distribution. And because it's a weighted average, it's a little bit more precise estimate. So it has more degrees of freedom. And so it's important to use if you have very few replicates per class. If you have 10 or more replicates per class, you don't need to use it. It's not necessary. When you get these T statistics or F statistics, once your degrees of freedom gets above a certain amount, it doesn't matter. It's only when you have very few replicates that the imprecision of being able to estimate the variances hurts you very badly in terms of the power of these t-tests or f-tests. So when you have very few number of replicates, it's important to use the random variance model.
So if we would publish on this, what would we say? What would we use?
You just give that citation.
No, but what would we these things are like a number. Could you just get that one?
Sure. What do you mean the number?
The number, the 0.01, is it alpha number? The univariate test.
Well, the random variance model, I mean, that's an issue, that's an option regardless of what alpha you use.
Right.
Those are sort of orthogonal issues. So, in other words, you do have to specify the alpha you want. So I guess the default is to use an alpha. Suppose you want to do a class comparison. You have very few replicates, and you're going to use just this this approach where you just use this top approach. Suppose that
can we think of this here as a like a t? Can we think of it as a t test?
You can think of it as a t test. It is just a modified t test. It's just a modified t-test where you're sort of sharing various estimates on other variants. It's still a t-test using 0.001.
And there are other packages out there that actually add up all the average all the variants?
Yeah, they're actually on there. Because the ones that sort of do analysis of variances for all genes simultaneously. We already talked about these univariate permutation tests, like the Wilcoxon tests. I generally think that's probably not a good idea. I think the multivariate permutation tests are much better. And then we have this option to perform the gene ontology observed versus expected sort of tables. SAM, significance analysis of microarrays, is essentially a multivariate permutation test, a little bit differently than the one we developed. We have this other tool for gene set expression comparison. The idea here is to, you want to find, say, gene ontology groups or pathways that are differentially expressed among your classes. And as we noted back here, you have this option of performing gene ontology observed versus expected. You know, in other words, if you do that class comparison, you will wind up with some gene list. One of the things, if you check that box, it will do it. It'll annotate that gene list with regard to what are the gene ontology annotations associated with the genes that came out significant in your analysis. And it also then looks at each of the gene ontology classes and says, well, in your gene list, do you have more representation of any gene ontology class than sort of you would expect, or what would be the expected number? And so it gives you this observed and expected. But it's really just sort of like a post hoc annotation of your gene list. These gene expression, gene set expression comparisons are not sort of post hoc annotations of gene lists. So it's possible you could come up with a gene set being either a gene ontology group or some kind of a biocarta pathway that could come up significantly differentially regulated between your classes, even though none of the genes in it were differentially expressed to such an extent as to get significant in one of your gene lists when you analyze genes one at a time. So it's possible that you'd have a whole bunch of genes in a pathway that are somewhat differentially expressed, but none of them make it to a p less than 0.001 kind of threshold. And so that's sort of the advantage of this tool, is it's not a post hoc analysis annotation of a gene list, but rather a direct analysis of gene sets. The other advantage of it is the reason we wind up having to be fairly stringent, like p of 0.001, and things like that for analyzing individual genes, is because there's so many individual genes represented on the array, but there's not nearly as many pathways represented, and there's not nearly as many even gene ontology category is represented. I think there's, in terms of biocarta pathways, human pathways, there's only something like 350 or something. So in terms of the p-value for controlling the multiple testing, you don't have to be as stringent. In other words, if there's only three, suppose you have, you're going to do 350 biocarta tests, and so it means if you did it at the 0.01 level, you'd have, you'd expect 3.5 false positives. Well, I don't know, that may be a little bit too high, but may not be. So in other words, you could get by with a 0.01 or a 0.005. You don't have to go to something as small as 0.001.
What column does it use to assess the GO terms? Does it use the column of the gene symbol, gene section number? Sorry, it's a program question.
Supriya, Amy, what do we use for relating things to gene ontology descriptors? Do we use gene symbol? Do we use clone ID? In other words, when we're annotating a gene list.
Either gene symbol, clone ID, or the new gene,
like if it's a, depending on which you have and
yeah.
in a certain level of priority. Probably gene symbol. We tend to try to use gene symbols if they're there. What we don't do is, several users have pointed out, we haven't corrected it yet, is we don't take into account that you may have multiple probe sets or multiple spots corresponding to the same gene.
Actually, that's one thing that I found really helpful, having the multiple, how it comes up, because oftentimes you go back and look at chips, sequences, some of them AFI hasn't gone through, and they're not as specific. So when those differential probe sets come up, throw out some of them because the specificity for them isn't there. That's not a feature that I want to get rid of.
Okay. Yeah, that. Okay. Now, the way this gene set expression compares, I don't know, this may be too much detail for many of you, more detail than you want or care about, but there's a lot of ways you could do this gene set expression comparison, and we're still sort of, people are publishing, I mean, other people from other places are publishing different ways of doing it, and we're sort of digesting this, and we're in the process of implementing we have two ways implemented now, and we're in the process of implementing a third way. I think it can be actually a very useful tool. We're also in the process of implementing additional gene sets. Right now, we have the gene ontology categories, the biocard and keg pathways, and also this broad institute and MIT have certain signatures. A lot of what they have are biocarta pathways, but they also have sort of collected signatures from the published literature of people who either overexpress some oncogene or silence some oncogene or something like that, and then they see how, what it does to gene expression, and then collect that list of genes. And so that's what the broad institute signatures are. And so we have this nice little tool for being able to download the data we need from their website onto your computer to use those signatures in a way that does not violate their copyright requirements. But we're trying to add gene lists, like we're about to add. We've taken known transcription factors and tried to identify target genes of each one of those transcription factors for human and mouse, and we'll make those available with the next release as gene lists, so that you can do that. And we're even thinking about doing it with protein domains for every PFAM protein domain to make a gene list of all of the genes containing that domain and things like that. The way these analyses kind of work is that for every gene in a gene list, you calculate a p-value, and then you calculate some kind of summary of those p-values, and then you determine whether that summary statistics is more extreme than you would expect for sort of a random sample of genes. And there's some, there's various kinds of summaries you can use. And the one that seems most, we have two of them implemented right now, in this LS statistic, which is the average of the log P values for the over the genes in that gene set, seems much more sensitive to differences than the other one, this KS statistic, this Kolmogorov-Smirnov statistic. So in the future, we may get rid of the Kolmogorov-Smirnov and replace it with this other method that that somebody else has been publishing that looks pretty good. So
the average log P, that's all it is.
Pardon?
It's just the average log P.
That's really all the summary is. Yeah, that's really all the LS is doing. Okay. This gene comparison between red and green samples, it's not a real great name for this tool, but this is really for situations where you're not just have a common reference and you want to compare this set of samples to that this class to that class or something like that. It's sort of like either you've used a design in which there is no common reference, and you sort of have sort of co-hybridized your samples from class A versus your samples of class B, and you want to find the genes that are differentially expressed, or situations where you have used a common reference, but that you actually, as a sort of a secondary issue, you're interested in finding what genes are differentially expressed between your, say, your tumors and your common reference. So I know we had one study where, we were studying different kinds of engineered breast cancers, mouse breast cancers, and the common reference was normal mouse breast epithelia, and primarily we were interested in these different kinds of breast cancers, but as a secondary issue we wanted to look at what was differentially expressed between each of them and normal breast epithelia. And so there you get into direct comparisons of the intensities in different channels. And we have a analysis of variance plugin of log intensities, it's called, for doing just that in a very precise and general and flexible manner. This was meant to be sort of a quicker tool for use in restricted situations. I won't. If you have that kind of data, we can talk about it afterwards on an individual sort of basis. We're actually enhancing this tool for the 3.5 version to make it not quite so limited. The quantitative trait analysis is very much like the class comparison, except you don't have classes. You're trying to find the genes that whose expression sort of correlates with some quantitative variable like tumor grade, where you have a bunch of different tumor grades, or could be age or something like that. And similarly, this is very similar. You want to find the genes that are correlated with survival for sort of, usually for medical studies where you have some censored survival data. Some of your patients are still alive, and you know what their survival time was of at the last follow-up, and you want to take that into account. So instead of using things like t-tests and ANOVA for the univariate tests or Spearman or Pearson correlation coefficients. For the univariate p-values, it uses these Cox proportional hazard regression p-values for when you have one gene in the model. Okay. Okay, this was really just the, trying to make the point that class prediction, prediction things are really a different kettle of fish. And a lot, I think there's a lot of confusion about developing prediction models because people are used to inference and rather than prediction. And also the statistics, kinds of statistical methods that are really appropriate for class prediction really are new methods because it's there's not a huge statistical literature on how you do prediction when your number of candidate predicting variables are orders of magnitude no more than the number of cases you have. The traditional context is where you have a handful of candidate predictors, maybe two hands full, but a lot of cases. And so much of the usual statistical apparatus for developing and evaluating regression models and prediction models actually doesn't work at all for situations where the number of candidate predictors are larger than the number of cases. So the components of class prediction, as I said before, a set of genes is not a class, is not a predictor. A set of genes is not a classifier. But it's one component of what you need for class prediction. So you need to decide what genes are going to go into it, and part of it is deciding, you know, what kind of a classifier type, like diagonal linear discriminant analysis or nearest neighbor or whatever else is going to be used, and then the third part of it is fitting the parameters or cutoff levels inherent in using that model for classification and prediction. And so the gene selection stage is usually actually the same kind of procedures that you might use for class comparison problems. But really the objective is very different. And so, for example, if you're going to say, well, I'm going to do my gene selection for class prediction of the genes that are significant univariately at some alpha level. Well, when we were talking about class comparison, we had some guidelines for how we're going to select that alpha. It was sort of controlling number of false positives, controlling the false discovery rate, that kind of stuff. For class prediction, we don't actually care about that. What we really want is we want accurate prediction. So the issue of it, is it good to be stringent? Is it bad to be stringent? Is it better to be less stringent? That has to be judged with regard to, is it good with regard to accurate prediction? So even though we may be using the same kind of formulas in the two cases, how we're using them really should be different. Now, a lot of people a lot of statisticians don't make that distinction. But really, the purpose of prediction is to predict. And the gene selection is just one component of that. Unfortunately, we don't really have really good guidelines. Is it good to be stringent or not stringent in selecting genes? I mean, I think the one guideline is that missing the informative genes is more serious than including noise genes. If you ever look at a lot of times you'll see graphs that sort of have number of genes in the classifier, and then you'll have error rate for the classifier. And the typical graph is like that.
if you're real stringent in selecting genes, so stringent that you miss the informative genes, your model becomes horrible. It's useless. If you don't miss the informative genes, it's just that you're unstringent enough that you get a bunch of noise genes in there. It hurts you some, but doesn't hurt you nearly as much as if you miss the good genes. So, so for prediction, you don't want to be real stringent. Now, the reason it's hard to make good general claims is I think what goes on is that in your data, if your data is such that you have if the informative genes are really strong, you know, they are really differentially expressed and tenfold, fivefold, you're not likely to miss them, then you can be pretty stringent in your gene selection phase, and you'll get rid of a lot of the noise genes and you'll still keep the good genes in there. But that's a pretty unusual situation. The more usual situation is that if you're not too stringent, there'll be a lot of informative genes, a lot of things that look like informative genes. If you get pretty stringent, you don't have very many real outliers like that. And the ones that are somewhat outliers, they may actually just be noise genes. And so in that situation, you're probably better off being less stringent, because otherwise you're likely to be down here. So it really depends on the nature of the data, but we have in BRB array tools, you can sort of run these things for different sort of alpha levels for stringency for selecting genes, and we even have a option in that class prediction tool for do it for a grid of alpha levels, and we even sort of do it in a valid way in which we say, well, for every leave one out training set, do it for the grid as an inner cross validation and then select the optimal. So but that is a dimension of developing a predictor that we can't tell you really exactly what's the best way to do it, and it does require, I think, just your sort of experimenting. There are methods that claim to do things more smart, to be smarter than just selecting genes one at a time. That is to try to select genes that work well together for use in classifiers. To use stepwise regression, complexity ranging from stepwise regression to genetic algorithms. A genetic algorithm is nothing but a combinatorial search algorithm for trying to look for genes that work well together. For the most part, it seems to me that all of these claims are wrong. That they're wrong either because they haven't compared them to they got good results on toy data that anything could classify well, or because they got good results on harder data sets, but they didn't actually evaluate the method properly. And I would love to find algorithms that particularly that give good classification with small numbers of genes. And so from time to time if an algorithm looks promising, published by somebody else, we'll put it in BRB array tools so that people can try it out on their data. And since we have these valid, cross-validation methods, you'll actually see whether it actually does any better on your data or not. And we have a couple of those kind of algorithms in there now. The most recent one we put in is called the top scoring pairs plug-in, but I have yet to see any of these that actually really perform well. But I think it needs more explanation, more exploration on real data sets, which they will get in BRB array tools. Now, I just want to mention that there are sort of the simpler kinds of methods. A lot of these methods are basically linear classifiers,
and a lot of them are nearest neighbor kinds of classifiers. So I just wanted to try to clarify what does it mean to say something's a linear classifier. Well, basically means that you wind up doing your classification based on calculating some weighted average of the log ratios or weighted average of the log signals for some selected set of genes. So you select genes that you think are informative for distinguishing the classes. Let's suppose we're talking about two classes. And then you figure out how you should weight the log expression levels for those genes. And you calculate this weighted linear combination, and this is I is just for gene I, and it's for gene I, the genes in some selected set of features, selected set of genes. Of course, we'll emphasize you have to do the selection separately for each training set when you're actually evaluating these models. But, and then X is just sort of the log expression level for the I gene in the sample to be classified. And so once you calculate this weighted average, this is just a number. And so you're just going to compare that number to some sort of threshold. It's either going to be above that threshold or below that threshold. And that, for a linear classifier, it's above the threshold, you say it's in class 2. If it's below the threshold, you say it's in the other class. And so the way these methods differ is either in the gene selection step or in determining how they determine these weights or how they determine this threshold. And well, we haven't implemented Fisher linear discriminant analysis. This is sort of probably the oldest kind of classification method in use, developed by R.A. Fisher. There have been studies, particularly by Sandrine Dudoit, and the Fisher linear discriminant analysis, it requires estimating the correlations among all the genes that are selected for being in the model. And if there are very many genes selected for being in the model, as often there are, because you don't want to be too stringent, then you have to estimate a lot of correlations. And it's not a problem with the amount of computation. The amount of computation is trivial with today's personal computers. It's just that you really wind up overfitting the data. And so many of the comparative studies that have been done, Fisher linear discriminant analysis actually does very poorly. What does actually better, has done better in many cases, is what's called diagonal linear discriminant analysis, which assumes that all of those the expressions for those different genes are independent. It assumes that the correlations are zero. Now, that is definitely a bad assumption. But making that bad assumption turns out to be better than trying to fit those correlations. I don't know if that's if there's a philosophical rule for all of us there, that it's better not to try to do something unless you're going to be able to really do it well or something like that. But anyway, diagonal linear discriminant analysis doesn't overfit the data, and it generally works pretty well. I have, however, seen situations where Fisher linear discriminant analysis does better than diagonal linear discriminant analysis. The compound covariate predictor that Michael Radmaker and several of us in my group developed is sort of an application of an older method due to John Tukey, and it's pretty similar to diagonal linear discriminant analysis, and it actually does very well. In some cases, it does a little bit better than diagonal linear discriminant analysis. Golub's weighted voting method is also very similar to diagonal linear discriminant analysis. And the compound covariate predictor differs only from diagonal linear discriminant analysis in that on these weights, one of them divides by a standard deviation and the other one divides by a square of a standard deviation. So, but they're basically very similar. And these things are really just like difference in average expression for class 1 and class 2, log average expression for class 1 and class 2 divided by either a standard deviation or a variance is the weights. Now, support vector machines with an inner product kernel. Support vector machines are one of these things that were given a catchy name and are sort of one of the darlings of the machine learning community, and they actually are nothing but linear classifiers. At least the ones with inner product kernel are linear classifiers. And they actually have a very good theoretical basis to them. They're really very similar to, in statistics, what's called ridge regression. And you would think that they might actually do better than some of the other linear classifiers, but in fact, they don't actually seem to. I won't spend time on how they actually work. When the number of candidate genes is greater than the number of samples, it's always possible to find a set of features and a weight vector for which the classification error on the training set is zero. And that doesn't mean the classifier is going to do well in predicting the things that are not right on its training set used for determining its weight and selecting its genes, but it does mean that because you have so many candidate genes to select from, even in developing a linear classifier, you are sort of squeezing all of the information out of that training set. That's probably why Fisher linear discriminant analysis doesn't work, is it usually so well. And it just sort of suggests that if there's not enough information in that training set generally for developing nonlinear classifiers in any sort of intelligent sort of way, since you can always find a linear classifier that's going to predict perfectly for any training set which is not inconsistent. So anyway, it sort of limits the motivation for studying complex nonlinear classifiers. Complex classification algorithms like neural networks, it's a myth, I think, generally, that they perform better. It's part of the hype of the field to try to get your paper published in a high-profile journal by using some method with a fancy name. The other kind of simple methods that generally perform well are these nearest neighbor methods, either nearest neighbor classification or nearest k-neighbor classification, or nearest centroid classification, or shrunken centroid classification. Just thought I'd go through a little bit how does the nearest neighbor method work, since it is an important method. So to classify a sample in the validation set, you determine its nearest neighbor of that sample in the training set. That is, which sample in the training set is the gene expression profile of this thing most similar to. And when we say which sample in the training set is its gene expression profile most similar to, we measure similarity using some selected set of genes that have been selected in your training set as being informative for distinguishing the classes. And you use some defined similarity measure like Euclidean distance or correlation to sort of decide how to actually explicitly calculate that similarity. And so you find, you have some training set, and in this training set you decide which genes you're going to use for distinguishing the classes, and you decide what kind of a similarity measure to use. And then when you have something you want to classify, you say, well, which sample in this training set is this thing most similar to with regard to those selected genes? And you find, and you call that thing its nearest neighbor, and then you say, okay, what class is its nearest neighbor in? Is it in class 1 or class 2 or class 3? And whatever class it's in, that's what you predict that other thing will be in. So that's it. That's how nearest neighbor method works, and it will work. It's not limited to two classes. And there's a generalization called the k-nearest neighbor, like 3-nearest neighbor, for k an odd number. And you say, well, okay, I have this training set of samples, and maybe I have two classes involved. And now I have this thing in the validation set that I want to classify. Let me first find its, okay, for this training set, I'll find the genes that, to me, distinguish class 1 from class 2. So I have this designated set of genes. And now for this thing I have to classify, let me find its nearest neighbor, but let me find also its second nearest neighbor and its third nearest neighbor. That is, the things that are the three elements of the training set that its expression profile seems most similar to with regard to that set of informative genes. And then now let me look at those three samples and say, well, are they all in class 1 or are they all in class 2? Or two of them in class 1 and one of them in class 2 or vice versa. And if two of them are in class 2 and one of them is in class 1, then I'll predict that that one to classify will be in class 2. So it's just sort of a majority vote rule. So again, it's very simple. And I, unfortunately, I can't tell you, I mean, usually these methods work very similarly. You don't, on BRB array tools, you get to try all of them, and it's unusual that one will do a whole lot better than the other. There's also the nearest centroid classifier, and in using that, there's one additional step involved. So you have this training set, and again, you select the genes that are informative for distinguishing the classes for these samples in the training set. And then what you do is you now you actually calculate the average gene expression, or the average log gene expression for each class, over the samples in each class in the training set. And you call those vectors of averages for class 1, you call that the centroid for class 1. It's just sort of the expression profile of the genes that are identified as being informative, where you've sort of averaged it over all of the samples in the training set that are in class 1, and then you have a centroid for class 2. And now when you have something new to classify, instead of finding its nearest neighbor, all you do is you say, is this expression profile more similar to the centroid for class 1 or more similar to the centroid for class 2? And you, depending on which one it's most similar to, you classify it in that way. And again, it generalizes to, there's no limit on how many classes involved. This top scoring pair is a recently developed method by some statisticians at Johns Hopkins that they published, and they're very good statisticians, and the method looks published-wise pretty promising for potentially developing classifiers based on genes that work well together in pairs and being able, not necessarily to do better classification than other methods, but to do as good a classification with fewer genes. But it remains to be seen whether, in a couple of data sets I've tried it on, I've not been too impressed with it. But we need to try it on more data. And so it's available in BRB Array Tools as a plug-in. Unfortunately, when we develop something from scratch, we usually program it in Fortran, which is a very highly efficient language. And I mean, even when we incorporated SAM, we didn't use the SAM software because it's slow. So we reprogrammed SAM in Fortran, so it's about 8 times faster than any other version of SAM available. But sometimes we're not sure how useful any of these methods are, and we sort of want to make, if I think they're promising enough, then I want to make it available in BRB Array Tools. But sometimes, like in this method, we'll use the software that the authors who developed the method made available. And that software is usually written in a language like R, which is a nice statistical language. It's easy to develop things in, but it's not anything like Fortran in terms of speed. And consequently, we were running this on somebody's data yesterday. It was very slow. And so the top scoring pair plugin is programmed in R. So, and I think the same thing for the random forest. The random forest is probably currently the most, the classification method of most interest to the machine learning community. You know, traditionally you had decision trees, decision tree classifiers, which were very nice in clinical kinds of applications because they're very interpretable. Is a patient male or female? If it's a male, is it stage? What's the tumor size? If it's a female, what's the, you know, some other characteristics? So you had these decision trees, and then at the bottom of the tree, you would classify people. And the path down the tree, the variables you would use for classification would be different depending upon what came above it in the tree. So they were very flexible and very interpretable. Well, it turns out for microarray kinds of classification, since you have so many potential variables, in many problems, a lot of times the problems are either easy for classification or hard for classification. On the easy methods, everything works well. On the really hard problems, nothing works well. But there's one exception. The single decision trees, even for the easy problems, usually don't work very well. And so they just overfit the data and give poor classification, usually. So what they've developed are these random forests, which are forests of decision trees, in which you develop all of these decision trees, and then you let each tree do a classification, and then you vote among those classifiers. And we included it, since it seems to be so popular in the machine learning community, but to me it seems like it gives up the basic attraction of the decision tree, which was interpretability, using a relatively small number of variables. And if you're going to use 100 trees, you know, I don't see the point. But anyway, we made it available. Yeah.
Now, when you say pairs of genes that work well together, are you talking biologically or statistically?
Just statistically. Yeah, they just, there's like this top-scoring pair. It really just looks at all pairs. It doesn't try to make sure that it doesn't look at the correlations among them or whether they're in the same pathway. It actually fits things like, I think, these Fisher linear discriminant models to these two genes, and you can do that when you have two genes involved. And it tries to find pairs of genes that that give good classifiers, and then it combines those pairs. But it does not look at biological annotations of those genes. We had an earlier thing in BRBRA tools in the class prediction tool that also does gene pairs. Whereas this top scoring pair looks at all pairs of genes, that the other one, it just sort of takes the if you say you want k pairs of genes, it will take the k genes that have this the lowest p value, that are the most differentially expressed among the classes, and for each one of those k genes, it will find another gene that seems to work well with it. But it doesn't look at all pairs, regardless of whether the one of the genes doesn't work well univariately. So there are two sort of ways of trying to do the same thing. And again, I think it would be I'm hoping that the top scoring pair thing turns out to work very well. I have a high regard for the people who developed the method, but I just don't know whether it's going to work. You know, the thing is, if you could do good classification with a small number of genes, then for medical applications, a lot of times what you really want to do is change your platform to a RT-PCR kind of platform, and that it's much more feasible to do that if you have a small number of genes than if you have a large number of genes. When there are more than two classes, all of the nearest neighbor methods work. Also, there's a decision tree of binary classifiers that we've developed in here. I don't want to spend too much. I don't know that I'll spend the time going over this, but it basically figures out. In other words, suppose you have four classes, just call them C1 through C4. Well, there's a lot of things you could do. You could start off by saying, try to distinguish C1 from, you know,
either C2, C3, or C4. In other words, you could group these together and try to develop a binary classifier that did that, and then you could try to distinguish C2 from C3 or C4, and then you could try to distinguish C3 from C4. Or you could start off by saying, well, let's try to distinguish the union of C1 and C2 from the union of C3 and C4, and then try to distinguish C1 from C2 and C3 from C4. So the way this decision tree of binary classifiers works is it starts off by saying, well, let me look at this sort of this. Let's call this S1 and this S2. So partition the classes in two disjoint sets. And then develop a binary classifier, say a diagonal linear discriminant analysis, that distinguishes this set from this set, and compute the cross-validated classification error for doing that. Okay? And so now I have a cross-validated classification error for using diagonal linear discriminant analysis to do this classification. Well, let me do it also for the problem for this part. And let me do it for when I try to distinguish C2 from C1, 3C, C3, and C4. In fact, let me do it for all possible binary partitions of my classes into two groups. So repeat the above steps for all possible partitions. Now, this is a partition. A partition is two sets such that each of our basic classes is in exactly one of the sets. You know, all of the classes are in one set or the other, and no classes in both sets. That's a partition. And we're going to develop a classifier and calculate its for this first level in all possible ways. We're going to get all those cross-validated classification rates. And then we're going to select the partition for which the cross-validated classification error is minimized. So maybe it turns out that it's minimized for the ones where I have C1 and C4, and I distinguish those from C2 and C3. Maybe this is the one whose diagonal linear discriminant analysis classifier gives the smallest cross-validated classification error of all of these, of all of the partitions I look at. There's a lot of possible partitions here. But at this point I'm just looking at this first level. So I find out that this is the one that has the smallest cross-validated classification error. And so I forget about all of the other possibilities, and I'm just going to focus on this one now. And now what I do is I just reanalyze this. Well, now it's obvious because there's only one more thing to do. I'm going to have to develop a classifier to distinguish C1 from C4 here, and a classifier for distinguishing C2 from C3 here. But it's possible I would have more options. So in other words, if the one that worked best was C1, C2, and C4, and had just C3 here, then I wouldn't know what to do next here. And what I would do is I would repeat that whole process. I would say, okay, now I'm going to consider all possible partitions of binary partitions of the ways of doing it, etc. So in general, if you have 10 classes, you just sort of work your way down. So it's a huge amount of calculation. But that's all done. You don't have to worry about it,
I guess.
Yeah, right. Let's see. So this is the main dialog box for the class prediction tool. And usually I just sort of select all of those
methods. It has, I guess the one thing that we need to focus a little bit on here.
Are these options over here, which, you know, can be kind of confusing. And usually, the default really, just select the genes based on univariate. And this is what we don't really know what to tell you to use. You know, try it with 0.001, try it with 0.01. Probably don't want to add any more zeros there. And one thing, and that's usually what I would try first. I would try it like this. I would try it with just 0.01. And it'll give you, you know, cross-validated misclassification. Let me just say, I'm going to talk a little bit more about this one, but I just wanted to show, this is the, when you press options, this is the dialog box. I would usually not check that box. Checking that box makes it really run slowly, because then it's going to redo the whole cross-validation procedure for all of the classifiers you selected for 1,000 or however many random permutations of the class labels. At some point, you may want to do that. It'll give you a p-value for is your cross-validated misclassification rate lower than what you would expect by chance. But for in terms of when you're figuring out how you really want to do the classification, that's going to slow it down terribly, so I would not do that. So
let's go back to this.
So I would try it like this, and I would try it with one fewer zero in there. And sometimes it might be interesting to check this box, too. In other words, this will then do the gene selection. In selecting genes with each training set, it will not only require that the gene be significant at some level, significantly differentially expressed, but it will also require that the fold ratio, the degree of differential expression, be above some level. Really, for classifying individual patients, you would like to have large fold effects. In other words, you could have a gene that was highly statistically significant, but didn't have much of a fold effect. That gene might not be really useful for classification purposes because when you really got around to using it, well, it got significant if that were the case because the variances were very large, but it might be sort of based on. Anyway, I don't know. Sometimes it's appealing to have genes in a classifier that have large fold effects, but you can experiment with this. A lot of times what you're going to find is that in the output, you're going to see that all these methods do about the same. And probably you're probably not going to be real sensitive to, if you make this too small, then your classification is probably going to be too small. As an alternative to specifying the significance level, you can specify univariate misclassification rate. In other words, to say, well, if I'm just going to use this one gene alone for classification, how well would it classify? Don't have a lot of experience with that. And this is the option for sort of optimizing over a grid of alpha levels, sort of automatically, to cross-validate. And to do that as sort of an inner loop within each cross-validated training set. There is before this top-scoring pair thing came along, we had this other gene pair way of selecting genes, and so this is an option to try. Here, it doesn't use a significance threshold at all. You just say, I want to select gene pairs, and I want, say, 25 gene pairs, or I want 5 gene pairs.
and it just picks the five, let's say the 25 genes with the smallest p-values for differential expression, and for each one of those genes, it examines all of the other genes to try to find one, the pair mate that works well.
So less sophisticated seeming than the other, the top scoring pair method, but it's based on a publication which I think is cited in the user's guide, and I thought it was potentially valuable enough to incorporate. It looked good in the publication. You know, my philosophy on a lot of this stuff is I don't like to make BRBRA tools just sort of an archive of bad methods. You know, like in Bioconductor, it's an archive. There's good stuff in it, there's bad stuff in it, and that's not really my intent with BRBRA tools. I like to sort of put methods in there that I think really are the methods to use, because a lot of the users are not really in a position to make that judgment themselves. But on the other hand, on some of these issues, we just don't know which are the best methods to use or the best methods to use. They're all valid, or we're going to provide valid evaluations of prediction error, but in terms of what are the best classifiers, we may not know, and it may depend on different sets, you know, your data set, and so we'll provide those options to try out. Leave one out cross-validation. So in other words, leave one out cross-validation. This is sort of complete leave one out cross-validation, where for each leave one out training set, it does everything from scratch in the sense of selecting the genes, starting with selecting the genes. For large data sets, if you have a lot of samples, it may be better to use tenfold cross-validation in the sense that it'll cut down the time, and there are actually some advantages to tenfold cross-validation. It tends to have a smaller variance of the estimate of prediction accuracy. If you have a very small number of samples, leave one out is better. 0.632 plus bootstrap is also a good method. Some cases, if you have also some samples that you want to get a prediction for, this use separate test set, that can be used for two different purposes, either because you actually want to make some predictions, or for samples that you don't have their class identifiers, or because you've decided, you know, in some cases, journal referees, they don't understand cross-validation, and since they don't understand it, they ask for a separate test set. And it's actually more efficient to just use cross-validation and not keep samples out for a separate test set, unless you have a large number of samples. It's a more efficient use of the data to just do cross-validation. But like I say, some journals prefer to see some separate test set, and so that's an option.
As I mentioned, this box will give you a statistical significance of the cross-validated misclassification rate for each of your models. And, you know, I guess you're familiar with, when you run one of these tools, it'll save the gene list, and you can give it a name for that. So if you run it and you try different things, you want to sort of use select names to remind you of what you've done, although really in the output HTML file that it will be saving, that includes the gene list and all of the other output information, it will have information in it about the parameters you use for the run. And usually you won't have to sort of start fiddling with the tuning parameters for the support vector machine. We've actually done some recent studies to see whether there are some better ways of fixing these parameters, and we found that the results seem very insensitive to the values of these parameters. There's also another popular method that we've incorporated called PAM, prediction analysis of microarrays. It's really the shrunken centroid method of Tib Shirani, and we've basically used his software, and so the output
is not exactly the way presented in the way we would present it, but you know, it's cross-validated properly, and we haven't seen any examples really where it gives any better results than the other methods. We talked about this binary tree class prediction. We have this new survival risk set prediction tool. How many of you have survival data that ran was it? Two? Okay, maybe we'll just, we can talk about that separately later, rather, because I'm sort of running slow here. And but I think this is a very good tool. It tends to be a little bit complicated to explain, and we are putting a lot of effort into enhancing it to use clinical covariates. We have a disk that sort of gives a enhanced version of it, enhanced relative to the 3.4 release, and I think it, for many people, this will be a very valuable analysis tool. There are some plugins that appear in the plugin menu. Particularly, we have sort of four analysis of variance plugins. Well, three, and this time course analysis is really a regression analysis kind of plugin. I mentioned earlier this one about ANOVA for mixed effects models, and the other one I mentioned earlier, this ANOVA for log intensities. That's if you have non-reference designs on dual label arrays, and this is sort of the ANOVA that is completely sort of general, or pretty completely general, and permits to analyze any of those kind of models to find differentially expressed genes. The time course ANOVA, basically what it does for each gene is it does a regression analysis using a quadratic time effect. And it permits you to answer two questions. What are the genes whose expression is changing over time? And now you could answer that question in a way using the class comparison. The only difference here is, since it's fitting a quadratic regression, it's actually taking you could have, in other words, if you did the different, if you did the class comparison, you'd be saying, well, I have maybe three time points or something, or four time points, and you'd be, if you have different times measured for different individuals, then you might want to actually take the actual measurement time into account, and you can do that with this regression plugin. That's probably unusual that you'd want to do that, but the other thing is, it could be that by taking the class comparison thing does not really take into account the ordering of the times, and this does, and so it permits you to answer with that one question, that is, what genes are changing over time, and the second question is. Permits you to answer is what, if I have maybe two classes, it permits you to say, well, what genes are changing over time differently for class one than for class two? Maybe they're not changing at all for class two, but they are changing for class one. So it permits you to sort of specify an interaction between time and class and say what genes have significant interactions. And it's actually very similar. There's a method published recently by Story for time course analysis, and it's very similar to that. The only difference is, I think he adaptively determines whether you should use a quadratic or some other degree polynomial, and he does permit in that repeated measurements on the same individual. And we don't have that yet in this time course analysis plugin. I think that's pretty much what I wanted to go over in terms of those plugins. This is just sort of using some of these plugins can be a little bit more, a little more challenging, because some of the plugins are general. So, but usually there's usually a README file associated with these plugins that give some hints on how to launch them. This is for the time course analysis and the ANOVA of log intensities. On the help, I just wanted to point out, under the help menu, there's a getting started thing. And one of the things that's available is this. I wrote this overview of the analysis tools. And I don't know if you've ever taken the time to read that, but that might be helpful. And then there's also a built-in tutorial and sample data sets. And under manuals, we have a sort of an extensive user's guide and also a plugin guide. And also there's this section I wrote, sample description of methods for publications. If you're writing up your results and you have to write a little statistical methods paragraph, I wrote a bunch of paragraphs here of the way I might write it depending upon what methods I use. So you might find, in other words, if you use the multivariate permutation test for class comparison, just look in that sample description of methods for publications and you'll see a paragraph that I wrote about how you might describe the multivariate permutation test and what citation to give to make it easier for you to write your method sections. There is a BRBRA Tools message board which on the BRBRA Tools website, which is pretty actively used. And you can post a question there. And then there's also a listserv that for some reason is not so actively used. And there's, you can also send a question to, what is it, brbratools@emmys.com? What's the URL, Supriya? What's the email address? brbratools@emmys.com? Yeah. I think I was just going to say something about evaluation, and I think I'm going to I'm not going to go through this in detail. I just want to emphasize again that we do, the cross-validation we do is sort of all aspects of the cross-validation, including the gene finding. Sort of proper cross-validation is the ideal sort of framework is you have one set of data to develop your model, and then you have a completely specified classification model. And what do we mean by a completely specified classifier? Well, if you have two classes, it means if you take that model and you plug in expression profile of a sample, it will output a class. So a completely specified expression classifier is not just a set of genes that you're going to then re-study in some independent set of data. So this is sort of a fundamental misunderstanding, I think. It particularly gets involved when people are doing clinical trials. They think that validation means that they're just going to see whether the same genes are predictive in their new clinical trial. And no, what it really means is you want to have a classifier that, say, predicts likely to respond, not likely to respond. And then you want to apply that classifier to a new set of patients and see, does it classify correctly or incorrectly? Not looking at the individual genes that are the components of that classifier, not redeveloping a new classifier for your validation set and seeing, well, how similar is it to my, none of that stuff. Just taking your completely specified classifier from your test, your training set, and using it to predict for a new set of data, and then evaluating how accurately it predicts. And when you talk about things like cross-validation, that's really what it's trying to simulate. You know, it's trying to say, okay, let me do this with leave on out cross-validation, but I'm going to try to use my data in a little bit more efficient way. So what I'm going to have is I'm going to have a test set that's just one sample. And everything else is my training set. But I don't want to violate the principle that I don't want to use that one sample in the test set for anything related, involved with the development of the classifier. I want to pretend like that sample in the test set doesn't even exist at the time I develop my classifier. And so I don't want to use that sample. I don't want to pool that sample with the rest of the data for figuring out what kind of genes to use and then use that classifier to predict for that sample, because then that violates that principle. So I want to pretend like that. So I have to develop this classifier from scratch with this training set and then predict for that one that was left out and then just record that I predict correctly or incorrectly. And then I repeat that N times, leaving a sample out one at a time. And so the key is though that I have to develop my classifier from scratch for each training set, and that includes selecting the genes. And I'm going to skip some of this. If this was in a simulated example, we've used in a couple of publications, it shows that if you use all of the, if you have data that's just totally random, there's actually no difference between your two classes in the expression levels of distribution of any of the genes. And if you use all of the data to select your genes that seem informative, and then you just use cross-validation to cross-validate model parameters for these, for models based on genes that you use all of your data to select for, what the cross-validation tells you is you almost always have perfect prediction. And it has to be wrong because you generated your data so that there's actually absolutely none of the genes are really informative for either of the classes. So the reason it works out wrong, it is unintuitive, but the reason it works out wrong is because you've used all of your data to select the genes and then just cross-validated the fitting of the model parameters. You wouldn't think it would make that much difference, but it actually does. And then we had a more recent paper looking at the various variants of cross-validation, like leave one out, tenfold, 0.632 bootstrap, split sample method. It turns out for small sample sizes, this split sample method is not very good, because it, for small sample sizes, if you say you split your data in half, use half of your data for developing your model and the other half for testing the model, if you have a small number of samples, you don't have enough. You don't wind up doing as good a prediction as you think as you could do. Though there's one point here, I guess I skipped over that I shouldn't have. And that's this point. If you do things like cross-validation, don't you wind up with a whole bunch of different classification models? So what do you report? And do you report sort of an average of them or the intersection of them or what? And so really the concept is I have a set of data and I have a way of developing a classification model. And so what I'm proposing to use in the future is developing my classifier on my full set of data. And so selecting the genes on the full set of data and fitting the model, the parameters for a classifier, that's what I am proposing to use for the future, because there I'm using all of my data. And the only thing is I want to give an estimate of how accurate I think that classifier is likely to be. And for getting that estimate, what I have to go through this leave one out cross-validation or some other kind of cross-validation rigmarole. It's really just for getting that estimate of prediction accuracy of this model developed on the full data set that I have to, for getting a valid estimate, I have to go through all of that procedure. And in going through that procedure, I actually have to develop all of these other models from scratch, including reselecting the genes. So I'm not actually using, in those procedures, I'm not actually using exactly the same model of what I'm reporting for people to use in the future. And so a lot of people, you know, I see papers and they say, we analyzed this data and we found 60 genes that were informative for these two classes, and we developed a classifier with these 60 genes, and using those 60 genes, our cross-validated expression, our cross-validated prediction error rate was less than 10% or something like that. And then I really worry, because, did they just, they say using those 60 genes, so if they did their cross-validation right, their cross-valid, each time they did it, had a cross-validated training set, they had a different set of genes selected. All of those models didn't select those same 60 genes. When you leave one out, one sample out, you're going to get a, you're not going to get all of those same genes selected. And so did they not realize that, and that they did the cross-validation right? It's just that they misstated what they did in their paper. Or did they really do it wrong? Did they actually select those 60 genes using all of their data, and then when they did their cross-validation, they limited it to just those 60 genes? And so you see a lot of papers, and I think what happens is both of them happen all the time. People do it wrong all the time and give cross-validated estimates in which they've pre-selected the genes, and the results they're giving are actually garbage.
But people never test them again.
Yeah. And you also see papers in which people did it right, but they didn't actually understand that when they did the cross-validation, the software they were using was reselecting the genes. And
so in this case, just sort of, it doesn't have to be totally mathematically accurate. We're getting sort of the greatest hits of the 50 times we did the cross-validation. Get the final list. That's your list from these class prediction methods. That list is in some way a summation or a lot of genes or a...
No, it's no. That list is actually where you analyze the full data set. So when we give you the output of a class predictor, and we give a gene list, that gene list is, in other words, if you have requested in your dialog box, select genes using 0.001. That list will be, if it did that for the full data set. Now, it did the, so that gene list, that set of genes will not be the genes that were used at each step of the cross-validation. But there's actually a column in that gene list that we give called cross-validated support. And for each of those genes, that column indicates the percentage of the training sets that that gene was selected for. But that list itself, it's not an average or anything, or it's not the union. It's really just the, if you apply...
You just had an additional column.
Yeah. And I've mentioned this random permutation. We've talked a lot about problems with incomplete cross-validation. With the survival risk group prediction, we have a way of comparing the prediction accuracy to what you could get with standard clinical predictors. And I'm not going to go through that. We do have a couple of publications now on sample size planning for expression profiling studies, and these are both the PDF reprint of this one is on our website, and the other one is in press, and it's also on our website. Kevin is here, so you can talk if you really have questions about sample size planning. I'm not going to go over it here, but talk to Kevin or me about it. We may, several people have suggested putting in sample size planning tools and BOBOA tools, so we might do that. It's different for planning for class comparison than it is for class prediction. This new paper is really the first paper that's been published by anybody really on anywhere adequate approach to how you plan sample size for developing a predictive classifier. And I think that's it. So I'm sorry I made it 3 hours. Well, actually, yeah, about 2.5 hours. But are there any questions, general questions, or issues that I didn't cover? There's a lot that I did not cover for obvious reasons. But you can either ask anything now or individually. I'm sorry?
I mean, can you arrange a class so that instead of going through every slide, everything that's in tools, in array tools, you give us let us do our work on it and then explain it? You know what I mean?
Well, actually, that's what comes next. So next is you analyze your data. And if you have a question about it, we have a lot of people here. You can ask those questions.
So a general question is, are you planning on going into different types of genomic data, like, say, DNA copy number analysis?
I think we would like to do the copy number and things like tiling arrays.
If you're going to now look for correlations between copy number and expression, would you use your quantitative trait analysis tool? So if you had a separate column for all your genes and then you had a copy value in that sampling, let's say it was paired.
I haven't really thought about it, so I'd hate to. First of all, I guess there's been a lot of papers published about how you do the copy number analysis. I think the first thing we want to do is, where we are is, we've tried to sort of get rid of some of the limitations of Excel and BOBOA tools. So we actually, the 3.4 release, we sort of don't store the expression profiles in Excel spreadsheets. And in order to handle the copy number data or some of these sort of things, there may be a lot of probe sets involved. And so we have to get we still have these gene annotation worksheets in Excel. So our next step is to get those out of Excel and stored just as files. And then our plan will be to decide which of the published methods for just doing the copy number analysis we'll use. And so I haven't really thought enough ahead about how. If you have, we can talk about that individually. If you have, that sounds like a good way to start, is to sort of, if you have sort of a estimate of copy number for associated with a gene, and then to one way or the other, either visually or analytically, look at sort of the correlations between those. You know, you could sort of think of having just some kind of a plot, you know, of those two kinds of things, or do it the plot separately by chromosomes, chromosome on or something like that.
If you consider, like, you know, you have a microarray, like you have a range of values. So if I have a binary values for the, so you think we'll be able to do some analysis. Some of my data sets, like, you know, have a binary value,
okay,
like 0 or 1, or like, you know, expression, like, you know, continuous range of values.
So you're saying instead of a continuous expression, you have
a binary value.
More like a binary.
Yes or no type of thing, like,
is this
for several genes or something. Like that.
Okay. Why is that? Is that?
So, you know, actually, like, I'm trying to use it for other methods.
Oh, okay, yeah, right. I was saying it sounds a little bit like SNP data or something.
Yeah.
Well, I would think, you know, probably some of the tools would probably still work okay. For example, I guess if you wanted to say, you know, if you have some permutation-based sort of thing, probably the normal distribution things might not work so well. But if you use sort of any of these multivariate permutation tests sort of things for generating gene lists, they probably would work okay, even if your expression data is you know, what it's thinking is expression data is actually binary data. So, yeah, I mean, that when you start talking about other kinds of applications, I mean, that's the obvious other one to genotyping data. And I really haven't thought, you know, it may, and something like that, it, you know, if when we somehow get hear that people are trying to use BRBRA tools for those purposes, then we start thinking about, well, gee, you know, what are there tools that, so that they might not be tempted to use the wrong tools, are there tools we could incorporate that would actually help? So I really haven't thought much about the genotyping data. But I think certainly some of the tools that are based on permutation analysis would work with
the mixed model and all of that.
Those are really ANOVAs are pretty much normal distribution assumption. So I don't think that would be good. I think for analysis of that kind of data, you know, if you're going to use some kind of a multivariate kind of thing, it'd be more likely to be a logistic regression would be the appropriate tool. And I was thinking of developing a logistic regression. I was thinking logistic regression for the outcome, but you're talking about for the expression data. No, those ANOVAs are assuming that the expression data is normally distributed with several sort of effects. So I don't think that would be good.
Let's
see. So the, you know, what we tend to do is sort of my standard way. We make the default, and so I think on the filtering, we do it a little differently if it's two color than if it's one color. The normalization. I think basically there's normalization again works differently if it's two color than if it's one color. Are you thinking more of two color? Okay. So there, basically the normalization methods are basically just for balancing the dyes on a given array, and the options for normalization for the two colors are really just to sort of balance it with regard to the overall, the median, so that the median red equals the median, median log red equals the median log green on each array. I think that's probably the default option. And the other option is, well, whatever sort of scaling you need to do to make the intensities in the two channels balanced, you know, there's a substantial literature to suggest that that scale correction is differently for the high intensity genes than for the low intensity genes. And so there's this business with low S smoothers that basically apply a different kind of normalization correction as a function of, you know, is it a high intensity spot or a low intensity spot. And then there's also a third option, I think. Do you want to have a separate scaling for each print grid, for each finger of the robot that's doing the printing? And I think my default is really to start with the simplest. And if you can start with the simplest, and I think we have one of the plugins that will give a this diagnostic plot for all of your arrays of this called MA plot, where it plots the as a function of the average red and green, it plots, I think, the difference or something. And I think basically that thing is supposed to be sort of flat. And so I guess my default would be to start with just normalization based on just scaling the medians to each other, and then running that plug-in to get a quick look at what those MA plots look like. And if they look really bad, then I would probably go to the low S smoother base normalization. Yes?
Are you planning on migrating VRV array tools to the Excel 2007?
Yes. I mean, we've sort of had a little bit of trepidation in terms of, in other words, whether they will change VBA so much that we'll have to do some real changes, and I'm not sure what that stands, but if we have to, we will. Okay, thanks. And like I say, there's restroom is right out to the left, and then there's a cafeteria. You go up to the first floor, and just in the adjacent building, there's a little cafeteria there on the first floor, and we'll be here for the rest of the afternoon, so don't feel like you have to rush or anything.